Broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo. Streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. Journalist Sheila Weller is my guest, and her latest book is Girls Like Us, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and the Journey of a Generation. It's a fascinating look at those three influential artists. Sheila Weller, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I want to start by asking, you know, in the era of pop songwriting that preceded the singer-songwriter era, which was definitely a male-dominated era, certainly, mm-hmm. The men who wrote the songs, they enjoyed long careers. Richard Rodgers and Irving Berlin, they did great work into senior citizenship.
Right.
And visual artists like Georgia O'Keeffe or Picasso and so on, they made great work throughout their lives. But it seems that the artists of the singer-songwriter era and beyond, they all accomplished their greatest work while in their 20s, the subject of your book included, although they've had long careers. But why do you suppose that is?
Right. Well, I did encounter that when I was writing this triple biography. Pop music is, you know, about love, and it's for the young. It really is. I mean, there's sort of no two ways about it. The women I wrote about keep going on. I mean, to this day, they're composing new songs and they're reperforming their old ones, they're rearranging their old ones. But it's hard to get around the fact that, you know, it's a medium about youth, about that fresh blush of love and confusion and, you know, and all of that. And it really connects to listeners. Pop music connects to listeners on that, you know, who are young.
I like to love that your love is love I can't be sure of. So tell me now and I won't ask again. Will you still love me tomorrow?
Each of the three subjects of your book, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, and Carly Simon, broke ground for women, and sexuality was definitely a part of their work. And so I wonder if we could touch on that with each of them.
Sure.
With Carole King, you write quite a bit about the song, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?
Well, it was actually, when you think about it, the first song that really has a presumably single woman discussing sexual agency. Those are very women's studies types words I'm using for a song, a bouncy song by the Shirelles at the beginning of 1961. But that's really what it was. I mean, before that, we had very sort of timid, you know, conventionally lyric songs. And this is a young woman who, if you look at the lyrics, she's saying, you know, she's basically going to take a chance with this guy, and the risk is hers. You know, will you love me tomorrow? I'm gonna sleep with you. I mean, this is kind of new, and it happened to come out just as Kennedy was elected, just as the birth control pill was rolling off the was being developed, and it was the first number one song by number one an African American girl group, and also by any girl group. I later discovered, so it really was kind of quietly groundbreaking.
Carole King, really, of the three of them, is the most influenced by African-American sounds, would you say?
She is.
Yeah. And, of course, she also was famous for a song called I Feel the Earth Move, which, mm-hmm. although is not directly about orgasm, but that was a phrase that people used a lot.
I guess so, yeah. I think the songs of Tapestry were kind of different. You know, they were about home to me. They were about reconfiguring your relationships, you know, at the very beginning of the 70s. But you know, "Will You Love Me? Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?" was definitely autobiographical. It was written with her, you know, first husband Jerry Goffin, and they kind of were very much a melded unit at the time. They were a young couple. She got married when she got pregnant. She got married to him in her teens, and they were, you know, writing songs together. And he kind of intuited her feelings, and they wrote the song together.
So it's the actual lyrics written by a man.
Yes.
Interesting.
But they're her, you know, her sensibility.
Well, Joni Mitchell and Carole King, while both singing about sexuality to a certain extent, and I guess Joni Mitchell maybe a little bit more than Carole King, but both of them did it in a kind of Earth Mama kind of way or hippie kind of way. But then Carly Simon comes into the story, and her sexuality was much more upfront.
Yes.
And the way she's pictured on her album cover, I mean, for years people referred to the No Secrets album as the nipple album.
Right, right.
And there was Playing Possum, which is a lot like a Victoria's Secret ad.
Absolutely, especially back then. It was banned from Sears and Roebuck.
and so that was a really upfront kind of sexuality, which now is pretty commonplace.
Right.
And in fact, most female performers, with, you know, very rare exceptions, present themselves in this way. So what I'm curious about is, how did these artists balance their sexuality with their feminist ideas?
Well, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write this, and looking back over an era that I lived through, is feminism came up in 1971. I mean, that's when it was, I mean, it was underground and worked on very intensely by women in collectives, but it really was sort of, as I put it, sold to America in 1971, Ms. Magazine. You know, a very attractive face, Newsweek, Time, etc. The years before that were the counterculture, what we then came to call the counterculture, the hippie era, the psychedelic era, where there was sexuality without feminism. You know, where women were really on their own to, you know, go out and live sort of as bohemian adventuresses. You know, without, you know, such things as dating or anything, you know, any rituals, you know, courtship rituals that existed before, nothing in the straight world, but none of the, there were no emotional protections. I mean, guys didn't have to, you know, treat them a certain way, you know, it was just, they were sink or swim. So it was those years of the mid to late 60s that I think were really important in developing a kind of an emotional armor and a kind of code of ethics, you know, or a code of survival, as it were, that young women developed, and that, for one, Joni Mitchell really expressed very well in an arc of songs that ended with Cactus Tree, which basically is a kind of a primer for how to do it, which is with your heart, my heart, you know, full and hollow as a cactus tree. I mean, here's a young woman living alone, you know, taking lovers, you know, adventurous in the world, willing to have her heart broken, but definitely had to hold her ground and kind of, you know, do it in a way that was new. You know, before this era, you know, young women who were, you know, sexually active but were single were considered desperate, even by the likes of Jack Kerouac in a novel like The Subterranean. So, you know, there was a lot going on in the mid to late 60s with you know, learning how to be, you know, sort of bohemian, you know, free-spirited young women and stay afloat.
There's a man who's been out sailing in a decade full of dreams, and he takes her to a schooner, and he treats her like a queen, bearing beads from California with her amber stone. He has called her from the harbor. He has kissed her with his freedom. He has heard her off to starboard in the breaking and the breathing of the water weeds. While she was busy being free.
It's interesting that you mentioned Kerouac when discussing Joni Mitchell,
yeah,
because Kerouac is famous for his book On the Road, and he
right.
kind of he sort of represented this beatnik you know, kind of mm-hmm. image of men traveling and so forth. And in Hejira, that's where Joni Mitchell takes to the road, and I think she influenced or inspired a generation of young women to leave their boyfriends and take off.
Absolutely. A leitmotif of hers is this, as she put it in one of the songs from Blue, traveling, traveling, traveling. You know, that rest, not just restlessness, but the sense, that artist's sense of leaving what is comfortable and familiar. Graham Nash, for example, in 1970, a man who was not only a superstar, but absolutely adored her and treated her very well. And she left him in the spring of 1970 to go and do live in a cave in Crete with a guy who was kind of, as she would put it in a couple of songs, a mean old daddy in a red, red robe, because she didn't want the comfort. She wanted, you know, to kind of hone her artist's, you know, blade by being, you know, out there and getting knocked around a little bit. A friend of hers who was one of the ladies of the canyon said life had been too comfortable. So this, but indeed, Hejira is the album in which she literally takes a road trip. And the second half of the road trip, east to west, she's driving by herself with a fake name and a red wig and writing all these wonderful road songs.
We're speaking with Sheila Weller, and her new book is called Girls Like Us, Carol King, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and the Journey of a Generation. When I first heard about your book, I have to say that I was struck with the trio of women that you chose. I could see Carole King and Joni Mitchell as being extremely influential, but I just didn't see Carly Simon in the same vein. How did you decide on these three?
Right. I always wanted to write a book about the history of the women of the 60s, and I was so aware of them, not just their songs that had landmark, you know, they made landmark points, but their lives and their persona. I mean, I think, you know, we, you know, sort of more or less age mates of theirs, or peers of theirs, looked across what I call the celebrity divide at them, the way young women today would now look at, oh, Sofia Coppola or Gwyneth Paltrow, or, you know, women who were, you know, celebrity versions of what they like to think they were. So I just felt very, you know, I knew that there was resonance. People have said, you know, they've said a lot of different things. They said, why not Joan Baez? They said, why not Bonnie Raitt? They've said all kinds of things. But Carly is, I think, represented something very important. I mean, she was that sort of Ms. Magazine type. I mean, she was the early 1971. The vibe had changed from the kind of, you know, Earth Mother long skirt thing to this very urban. Think of the women in early 1971, Erica Jong and Gloria Steinem and Allie McGraw and Jane Fonda. They went to Seven Sisters colleges. They wore those sleek pants and ponchos. It was a sort of sarcastic, smart, urban, you know, girl who embodied what this new feeling was, which was feminism. And Carly's That's the Way I Always Heard It Should Be was the first song in which a woman basically is saying, I don't want to get married because I don't want to be kept on a shelf. That was always what a guy thought. And then, of course, You're So Vain is the most, you know, the real kick-ass feminist, you know, rock song. So she really, you know, she really has a place in it.
You walked into the party like you were walking onto a yacht. Your hat strategically dipped below one eye. Your scarf.
I'm guessing that Carly Simon has probably sold more records than Joni Mitchell and Carole King.
I think they've all done different things. I think of all the songs in the book, the one that is the most recognized in this country, I think I said in one interview, I think George Bush Sr. knows about You're So Vain. Is You're So
Vain.
It's
about him, I think.
I think they're all, you know, I mean, a lot of Joni's songs were covered lucratively by others. You know, I mean, she... wrote songs that were more popularized by others than her versions of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all kind of had different, you know, and Tapestry, of course, was an amazingly, high-selling album.
And that remained on the charts for 10 years, I believe, or something like
It was in the top 100 for 6 years.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah, amazing.
And it's just been re-released with a live version.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, they're all still around. Joni just did a new album recently,
yes.
And Carly Simon has a new album.
Brand new album, yeah.
And I think they're all doing good work, although, as I said earlier, certainly not the work they did earlier in their careers. And Carole King, her songs were covered. I mean, she was a songwriter before a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Beatles covered a couple of her.
Yes, they loved her. When they came on their first trip to New York, they wanted to meet Goffin and King. They didn't even know who they were. They just said, we want to meet Goffin and King. And they did.
Did they? Uh-huh.
Yes, Carole met them, yeah.
What was that meeting like, do you know?
Well, it was actually a kind of a landmark meeting. First of all, Carole got to meet the Beatles and John Lennon. Like, you know, they were all utterly charming to Carole, who was at the time, you know, a New Jersey housewife with two kids. You know, just a songwriter. She wasn't glamorous. She wasn't famous. She was knocking out songs for others. They were great songs, but she wasn't a star. But what was significant about that meeting is the guy who set it up, Al Aronowitz, who was an old New York Post and Look magazine or Life magazine writer, became friends with the Beatles' roadie and was also a friend of Bob Dylan, and he is the one who got Bob Dylan to the Beatles, and Bob Dylan turned the Beatles on to Grass. So all the wonderful albums that we know, you know, when we think of the Beatles, you know, the real Beatles, not the I Want to Hold Your Hand, but the counterculture Beatles came from that meeting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Carole King songs that people might not know are Carole King songs,
mm-hmm.
such as Up on the Roof or
mm-hmm.
what
Natural Woman. When Aretha was awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by Essence Magazine or Black Entertainment, a major African-American group, you know, on TV about 3 months ago, you know, standing ovation. They played all of her wonderful songs, Respect, This, That, you know, all of her wonderful songs. But the song that was her song, the one that they played when she walked to the podium with the standing ovation, was Natural Woman. And that was written by Carole King.
And some of the great rock groups of the 60s
mm-hmm.
relied on her as a songwriter.
Yes.
The Byrds, the Monkees, the...
Well, the Monkees were kind of pop. You know, they were kind of a faux group. The Byrds, they finally got a song to the Byrds. I mean, you know, Carole and Jerry wrote these wonderful pop soul songs, but then when the Beatles and Dylan came in, you know, they felt very insecure, especially Jerry, that they weren't doing the right hip thing. So they wrote a song for the Byrds and got the Byrds to record, and they felt they had counted, you know, in the new scheme of things. But that same year, they wrote Natural Woman, which was so much a better song.
And you were mentioning that Joni, you know, kind of got on the map. I don't know, I was reading President Clinton's autobiography,
mm-hmm.
and he talks about how he and his wife came up with the name Chelsea for
exactly,
their daughter.
Yes.
And he said, it was the great Judy Collins song, mm-hmm. Chelsea Morning,
mm-hmm.
which is, we know.
Well, yeah, well, Judy did write, did record it.
Yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. But I think since then they've in most citations they mentioned that it's a Joni song.
I have a version of maybe I'll play it for you. I have a version of Both Sides Now performed by Doris Day.
Oh, by Doris Day.
Yeah. Oh. No kidding.
Oh, I'd love to hear that. I thought you were going to say obviously by Judy, which was the landmark. I mean, the Judy's version of Both Sides Now in 1968 was the as I put it in my book, you know, the you know, if you were a young woman in 1968, that was your version of what got, you know, older men, you know, look to Sinatra's My Way, too. It was like an anthem.
Sinatra recorded Both Sides Now.
He might have.
Yeah, no, he did.
I think Willie Nelson did.
Yeah, oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's still being recorded by...
Yeah.
And ice cream castles in the air, and feathered canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way.
and down, and still somehow it's cloud's illusions.
Cloud illusions. I recall, I really don't know clouds.
Sheila Weller is my guest, and her latest book is called Girls Like Us, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and the Journey of a Generation. Do you think that Joni Mitchell's music was all autobiographical? She denies that it is, but I'm asking you what you think.
Oh, she says all kinds of things. I mean, you know, she's such a wonderfully opinionated, you know. I think a lot of it was. I mean, I went on a treasure hunt looking for who these songs were about. You know, a great many of them were. Certainly the songs from Blue, the songs from For the Roses, a great many of them were.
And did you find out who Carly Simon's You're So Vain is about? Am I wrong? It's not about George Bush Sr.?
It's not about George. Who should call and break the news? You or me?
it's Warren Beatty or it's Mick Jagger or something.
It's not Mick Jagger, although Mick Jagger was much more important in her life than Warren Beatty. But it is pretty certainly about Warren Beatty. I think it's about Warren Beatty plus some. I think it's about Warren Beatty plus the other guys in that Warren Beatty circle.
I see.
Who she kind of hung out with at the same time.
What a great song. One of the things that unites Carole King, Joni Mitchell, and Carly Simon is James Taylor.
Yes. What's
what's the story of that?
Well, you know, if there are girls, there's always the boy, right?
Yeah.
He turned out to be the boy. He and Carol were like a musical mutual admiration society. They were in the same little group of friends, musical friends and lovers. It was a little crowd in Laurel Canyon, which I think inspired the songs of Tapestry. Anyway, James and Carol really helped each other. He got her over her fear of performing. She wrote You've Got a Friend that was his only number one hit. They were really, really close friends. At the same time, he was in love with Joni Mitchell, and they were kind of the counterpart, tall, beautiful, sensitive singer-songwriter, male version, female version. And Joni wrote a number of her beautiful songs for Blue for him in that summer of 70. And then he and Joni broke up, and he met Carly in April 71 at her debut at the Troubadour, and she had been a huge fan of his, and there were parallels in their lives. I mean, they both were from sort of like almost, you know, we could use the word aristocratic family, so to speak, especially his. And in November of 72, they got married. I mean, they were together for about a year before that. It was a very intense relationship. And if you go back and read what he said about her in Rolling Stone, I mean, this very, very super cool, taciturn drug addict guy was like talking about how madly in love with her he was. So it was very romantic, and people definitely picked that up. And when they got married, young women kind of looked at them and said, you know, we're not supposed to want to get married now, but I would break that for him.
Well, that brings me to another question about Carly Simon. We talked earlier about her sexuality and her sort of model body that she put on display without too much shame. And now that's kind of the thing that all female artists do. And they eschew feminism. They actually say it.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think of Carly Simon's influence as a positive or negative?
Oh, well, I think that all their influences are totally positive. I think a lot of these young women really are, really embody feminism to an enormous degree. I mean, Mariah Carey, people like that are, we look at them, they're always in short skirts, and on the surface, they're not what a 1971 version of feminism is. She's a businesswoman. They've got so much more control over their work. There are many corporations. That wouldn't exist without what went on in the late 60s and early 70s. I mean, and Carly, I mean, there were definitely women who vamped it up. I mean, there were definitely, you know, sexy girls before. But what Carly did was she had that, you know, I went to Sarah Lawrence, all my friends were writers and psychotherapists, air about her, and it takes someone like that to take sexuality. And at that moment, we were in the middle of a very, you know, the sexual revolution, to take sexuality and make it, you know, respectable. And I think that's basically what she did. You know, there used to be there are the Marilyn Monroes, and then there are the, you know, other, you know, I think she kind of melded it. She took the sexual revolution plus, you know, mainstream feminism, and that's what she embodied. But today, you know, you could say that, you know, we're in a post-feminist era. You could say we're in a post-post-feminist era. But I think there are things that young women are just take for granted now, like making money, like having, you know, business sense, like getting prenuptial arrangements, uh-huh. You know, that just, you know, will never be erased, no matter how many giggly little girls, you know, Girls Gone Wild pictures they pose for in Us magazine.
Well, of the artists that you wrote about, who cooperated with you in writing the book?
Well, I, this is a, you know, a unauthorized book, you know, and I actually didn't ask to speak to any of the three of them, believe it or not, because I, number one, thought that was a really tall order, and B, I didn't want to be influenced, I didn't want to be scared of them, like, you know, you get into, you know, it's hard enough investigating people who are very well known and well respected without having them, you know, you have to answer to them. But Carly actually came to me, and that's kind of an example of who she is. She's very out there. She's very, you know, open. And she came to me and made herself available. And I didn't talk to her all that much, and we did email. I didn't want to make it uneven, but she did, you know, really like the idea and wanted to participate and help in any way she could.
And have you gotten any reaction from the other two?
No. I've gotten reaction from people who know them, who knew them during the times that I wrote about, and it's been very, you know, gratifyingly to me. It's been very, you really got it, you know, it's right on. I don't know, and I kind of doubt that Joni or Carol has read the book, but I'm dying to know if they, you know, when they do.
Well, I
sent them copies.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I think they should, because you sent me a copy and I loved it, and I think everybody listening would love it too. It's called Girls Like Us, Carol King, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and The Journey of a Generation. The author is Sheila Weller. Sheila, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.